Billy read the opinion of a staff judge advocate who reviewed Slovak's case, which ended like this. He has directly challenged the authority of the government, and future discipline depends upon a resolute reply to this challenge. If the death penalty is ever to be imposed for desertion, it should be imposed in this case not as a punitive measure nor as retribution, but to maintain that discipline upon which alone an army can succeed against the enemy. There was no recommendation for clemency in the case, and none is here recommended. So it goes. Now somebody was shaking Billy awake. He was back in the Second World War again, behind the German lines. The person who was shaking him was Roland Weary. Weary had gathered the front of Billy's field jacket into his hands. He banged Billy against a tree, then pulled him away from it, flung him in the direction he was supposed to take under his own power. Billy stopped, shook his head. "You go on," he said. "What? You guys go on without me. I'm all right." "You're what?" "I'm okay." "Jesus, I'd hate to see somebody sick," said Weary, through five layers of humid scarf from home. Billy had never seen Weary's face. He had tried to imagine it one time, had imagined a toad in a fishbowl. Weary kicked and shoved Billy for a quarter of a mile. The scouts were waiting between the banks of a frozen creek. They had heard the dog. They had heard men calling back and forth, too, calling like hunters who had a pretty good idea of where their quarry was. The banks of the creek were high enough to allow the scouts to stand without being seen. Billy staggered down the bank ridiculously. After him came Weary, clanking and clinking and tinkling and hot. "Here he is, boys," said Weary. "He don't want to live, but he's going to live anyway. When he gets out of this, by God, he's going to owe his life to the Three Musketeers." Billy Pilgrim, there in the creek bed, thought he, Billy Pilgrim, was turning to steam painlessly. If everybody would leave him alone for just a little while, he thought, he wouldn't cause anybody any more trouble. He would turn to steam and float up among the treetops. Somewhere, the big dog barked again. With the help of fear and echoes and winter silences, that dog had a voice like a big bronze gong. Roland Weary, 18 years old, insinuated himself between the scouts, draped a heavy arm around the shoulder of each. "So what do the Three Musketeers do now?" he said. Billy Pilgrim was having a delightful hallucination. He was wearing dry, warm, white sweat socks, and he was skating on a ballroom floor. Thousands cheered. This wasn't time travel. It had never happened, never would happen. It was the craziness of a dying young man with his shoes full of snow. One scout hung his head, let spit fall from his lips. The other did the same. They studied the infinitesimal effects of spit on snow and history. They were small, graceful people. They had been behind German lines before many times, living like woods creatures, living from moment to moment in useful terror, thinking brainlessly with their spinal cords. Now they twisted out from under Weary's loving arms. They told Weary that he and Billy had better find somebody to surrender to. The scouts weren't going to wait for them anymore. And they ditched Weary and Billy in the creek bed. Weary was filled with a tragic wrath. He had been ditched again. He stuffed his pistol into its holster. He slipped his knife into its scabbard. And then he shook Billy hard, rattled his skeleton, slammed him against a bank. Weary barked and whimpered through his layers of scarf from home. He spoke unintelligibly of the sacrifices he had made on Billy's behalf. He dilated upon the piety and heroism of the Three Musketeers, portrayed in the most glowing and impassioned hues, their virtue and magnanimity, the imperishable honor they acquired for themselves, and the great services they rendered to Christianity. It was entirely Billy's fault that this fighting organization no longer existed, Weary felt, and Billy was going to pay. Weary socked Billy a good one on the side of the jaw, knocked Billy away from the bank and onto the snow-covered ice of the creek. Billy was down on all fours on the ice, and Weary kicked him in the ribs, rolled him over on his side. Billy tried to form himself into a ball. "You shouldn't even be in the army," said Weary. Billy was involuntarily making convulsive sounds that were a lot like laughter. "You think it's funny, huh?" Weary inquired. He walked around to Billy's back. Billy's jacket and shirt and undershirt had been hauled up around his shoulders by the violence, so his back was naked. There, inches from the tips of Weary's combat boots, were the pitiful buttons of Billy's spine. Weary drew back his right boot, aimed a kick at the spine, at the tube which had so many of Billy's important wires in it. Weary was going to break that tube. But then Weary saw that he had an audience. Five German soldiers and a police dog on a leash were looking down into the bed of the creek. The soldiers' blue eyes were filled with bleary civilian curiosity as to why one American would try to murder another one so far from home, and why the victim should laugh. Two of the Germans were boys in their early teens. Two were ramshackle old men. They were irregulars, armed and clothed fragmentarily with junk taken from real soldiers who were newly dead. So it goes. Their commander was a middle-aged corporal, red-eyed, scrawny, tough as dried beef, sick of war. His bandy legs were thrust into golden cavalry boots, which he had taken from a dead Hungarian colonel on the Russian front. So it goes. Lying on the black ice there, Billy stared at the corporal's boots. Next to the golden boots were a pair of feet which were swaddled in rags. They were crisscrossed by canvas straps, were shod with hinged wooden clogs. Billy looked up at the face that went with the clogs. It was the face of a blonde angel of a 15-year-old boy. Billy was helped to his feet by the lovely boy, and the others came forward to dust the snow off Billy, and then they searched him for weapons. He didn't have any. The most dangerous thing they found on his person was a 2-inch pencil stub. 3 inoffensive bangs came from far away. They came from German rifles. The 2 scouts who had ditched Billy and Weary had just been shot. They'd been lying in ambush for Germans. They'd been discovered and shot from behind. Now they were dying in the snow, feeling nothing, turning the snow to the color of raspberry sherbet. So it goes. So Roland Weary was the last of the 3 musketeers. And Weary, bug-eyed with terror, was being disarmed. The corporal gave Weary's pistol to the pretty boy. He marveled at Weary's cruel trench knife, said in German that Weary would no doubt like to use the knife on him. He tore open Weary's overcoat and blouse. Brass buttons flew like popcorn. The corporal reached into Weary's gaping bosom as though he meant to tear out his pounding heart, but he brought out Weary's bulletproof Bible instead. A bulletproof Bible is a Bible small enough to be slipped into a soldier's breast pocket over his heart. It is sheathed in steel. The corporal found the dirty picture of the woman and the pony in Weary's hip pocket.
"What a lucky pony, huh? Don't you wish you were that pony?"
He handed the picture to the old man.
"Spoils of war. It's yours, all yours, you lucky lad."
Then he made Weary sit down in the snow and take off his combat boots, which he gave to the beautiful boy. He gave Weary the boy's clogs. So Weary and Billy were both without decent military footwear now, and they had to walk for miles and miles with Weary's clogs clacking, with Billy bobbing up and down, crashing into Weary from time to time. "Excuse me," Billy would say, or, "I beg your pardon." They were brought at last to a stone cottage at a fork in the road. It was a collecting point for prisoners of war. Billy and Weary were taken inside, where it was warm and smoky. There was a fire sizzling and popping in the fireplace. The fuel was furniture. There were about 20 other Americans in there, sitting on the floor with their backs to the wall, staring into the flames, thinking whatever there was to think, which was zero. Nobody talked. Nobody had any good war stories to tell. Billy and Weary found places for themselves, and Billy went to sleep with his head on the shoulder of an unprotesting captain. The captain was a chaplain. He was a rabbi. He had been shot through the hand. Billy traveled in time, opened his eyes, found himself staring into the optometer in his office in Ilium. It was 1967, which would make Billy Pilgrim 44 years old. He asked himself this: where have all the years gone? Billy closed his eyes. When he opened them, he was back in the Second World War again. His head was on the wounded rabbi's shoulder. A German was kicking his feet, telling him to wake up, that it was time to move on. The Americans, with Billy among them, formed a fool's parade on the road outside. Billy was simultaneously on foot in Germany in 1944 and riding his Cadillac in 1967. Germany dropped away and 1967 became bright and clear, free of interference from any other time. Billy was on his way to a Lions Club luncheon meeting. It was a hot August, but Billy's car was air-conditioned. He was stopped by a signal in the middle of Ilium's black ghetto. The people who lived here hated it so much that they had burned down a lot of it a month before. It was all they had, and they'd wrecked it. The neighborhood reminded Billy of some of the towns he'd seen in the war. The curbs and sidewalks were crushed in many places, showing where the National Guard tanks and half-tracks had been. Blood Brother said a message written in pink paint on the side of a shattered grocery store. There was a tap on Billy's car window. A black man was out there. He wanted to talk about something. The light had changed. Billy did the simplest thing. He drove on. Billy drove through a scene of even greater desolation. It looked like Dresden after it was firebombed, like the surface of the moon. The house where Billy had grown up used to be somewhere in what was so empty now. This was urban renewal. A new Ilium government center and a pavilion of the arts and a peace lagoon and high-rise apartment buildings were going up here soon. That was all right with Billy Pilgrim. The speaker at the Lions Club meeting was a major in the Marines. He said that Americans had no choice but to keep fighting in Vietnam until they achieved victory, or until the communists realized that they could not force their way of life on weak countries. The major had been there on two separate tours of duty. He told of many terrible and many wonderful things he had seen. He was in favor of increased bombings, of bombing North Vietnam back into the Stone Age if it refused to see reason. Billy was not moved to protest the bombing of North Vietnam, did not shudder about the hideous things he himself had seen bombing do. He was simply having lunch with the Lions Club, of which he was past president now. Billy had a framed prayer on his office wall which expressed his method for keeping going, even though he was unenthusiastic about living. A lot of patients who saw the prayer on Billy's wall told him that it helped them to keep going too. It went like this: God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom always to tell the difference. Among the things Billy Pilgrim could not change were the past, the present, and the future. Now he was being introduced to the Marine Major. The person who was performing the introduction was telling the Major that Billy was a veteran and that Billy had a son who was a sergeant in the Green Berets in Vietnam. The Major told Billy that the Green Berets were doing a great job and that he should be proud of his son. "I am. I certainly am," said Billy Pilgrim. Billy's home was empty. His daughter Barbara was about to get married, and she and his wife had gone downtown to pick out patterns for her crystal and silverware. He lay down, but sleep would not come. Tears came instead. They seeped. He closed his eyes and opened them again. He was still weeping, but he was back in Luxembourg again. He was marching with a lot of other prisoners. It was a winter wind that was bringing tears to his eyes. At each road intersection, Billy's group was joined by more Americans with their hands on top of their heads. Billy had smiled for them all. They were moving like water, downhill all the time, and they flowed at last to a main highway on a valley's floor. Through the valley flowed a Mississippi of humiliated Americans. Tens of thousands of Americans shuffled eastward, their hands clasped on top of their heads. They sighed and groaned. Billy and his group joined the river of humiliation, and the late afternoon sun came out from the clouds. The Americans didn't have the road to themselves. The westbound lane boiled and boomed with vehicles which were rushing German reserves to the front. The reserves were violent, windburned, bristly men. They had teeth like piano keys. They were festooned with machine gun belts, smoked cigars, and guzzled booze. They took wolfish bites from sausages, patted their horny palms with potato masher grenades. They were climbing a gentle rise now. When they reached the top, they weren't in Luxembourg anymore. They were in Germany. And the sun went down, and Billy found himself bobbing in place in a railroad yard. There were rows and rows of boxcars waiting. They had brought reserves to the front. Now they were going to take prisoners into Germany's interior. Flashlight beams danced crazily. The Germans sorted out the prisoners according to rank. They put sergeants with sergeants, majors with majors, and so on. A squad of full colonels was halted near Billy. One of them had double pneumonia. He had high fever and vertigo. As the railroad yard dipped and swooped around the colonel, he tried to hold himself steady by staring into Billy's eyes. The colonel coughed and coughed, and then he said to Billy, "You one of my boys?" This was a man who had lost an entire regiment, about 4,500 men, a lot of them children, actually. Billy didn't reply. The question made no sense. There was a silence, with the colonel dying and dying, drowning where he stood. And then he cried out wetly, "It's me, boys! It's Wild Bob!" That's what he had always wanted his troops to call him. Wild Bob. The colonel imagined that he was addressing his beloved troops for the last time. He said that after the war he was going to have a regimental reunion in his hometown, which was Cody, Wyoming. He was going to barbecue whole steers. He said all this while staring into Billy's eyes. "God be with you, boys," he said, and that echoed and echoed. And then he said, "If you're ever in Cody, Wyoming, just ask for Wild Bob." I was there. So was my old war buddy, Bernard V. O'Hare. Billy Pilgrim was packed into a boxcar with many other privates. Weary was packed into another car in the same train. Most of the privates on Billy's car were very young, at the end of childhood. But crammed into the corner with Billy was a former hobo who was 40 years old. "I've been hungrier than this," the hobo told Billy. "I've been in worse places than this. This ain't so bad." A man in a boxcar across the way called out through the ventilator that a man had just died in there. So it goes. The guards weren't excited by the news. They got a stretcher out of their own cozy car, opened the dead man's car, and went inside. The dead man's car wasn't crowded at all. There were just 6 live colonels in there, and 1 dead one. The Germans carried the corpse out. The corpse was Wild Bob. So it goes. During the night, some of the locomotives began to tootle to one another and then to move. The locomotive and the last car of each train were marked with a striped banner of orange and black, indicating that the train was not fair game for airplanes, that it was carrying prisoners of war. The war was nearly over. The locomotives began to move east in late December. The war would end in May. German prisons everywhere were absolutely full, and there was no longer any food for the prisoners to eat, and no longer any fuel to keep them warm. And yet, here came more prisoners. Billy Pilgrim's train, the longest train of all, did not move for 2 days. "This ain't bad," the hobo told Billy on the second day. "This ain't nothing at all." Even though Billy's train wasn't moving, its boxcars were kept locked tight. Nobody was to get off until the final destination. To the guards who walked up and down outside, each car became a single organism which ate and drank and excreted through its ventilators. It talked or sometimes yelled through its ventilators, too. Human beings in there took turns standing or lying down. The legs of those who stood were like fence posts driven into a warm, squirming, farting, sighing earth. The queer earth was a mosaic of sleepers who nestled like spoons. Now the train began to creep eastward. Somewhere in there was Christmas. Billy Pilgrim nestled like a spoon with the hobo on Christmas night, and he fell asleep, and he traveled in time to 1967 again, to the night he was kidnapped by a flying saucer from Trafalmador. Billy Pilgrim could not sleep on his daughter's wedding night. He was 44. The wedding had taken place that afternoon in a gaily striped tent in Billy's backyard. Billy and his wife, Valencia, nestled like spoons in their big double bed. Valencia was snoring like a bandsaw. There was a full moon. Billy got out of bed in the moonlight. He felt spooky and luminous, felt as though he were wrapped in cool fur that was full of static electricity. He looked down at his bare feet. They were ivory and blue. Billy Pilgrim padded downstairs on his blue and ivory feet, knowing he was about to be kidnapped by a flying saucer. In the kitchen, Billy looked at the clock on the gas stove. He had an hour to kill before the saucer came. He went into the living room, turned on the television. He came slightly unstuck in time, saw the late movie backwards, then forwards again. It was a movie about American bombers in the Second World War and the gallant men who flew them. And then it was time to go out into his backyard to meet the flying saucer. Out he went, his blue and ivory feet crushing the wet salad of the lawn. He would not raise his eyes to the sky, though he knew there was a flying saucer from Tralfamador up there. He would see it soon enough, inside and out, and he would see, too, where it came from soon enough. Soon enough. Overhead he heard the cry of what might have been a melodious owl, but it wasn't a melodious owl. It was the flying saucer from Tralfamador, navigating in both space and time, therefore seeming to Billy Pilgrim to have come from nowhere all at once. Somewhere a big dog barked. The saucer was 100 feet in diameter, with portholes around its rim. The light from the portholes was a pulsing purple. The only noise it made was the owl song. It came down to hover over Billy and to enclose him in a cylinder of pulsing purple light. Now there was the sound of a seeming kiss as an airtight hatch in the bottom of the saucer was opened. Down snaked a ladder that was outlined in pretty lights like a Ferris wheel. Billy's will was paralyzed by a zap gun aimed at him from one of the portholes. It became imperative that he take hold of the bottom rung of the sinuous ladder, which he did. The rung was electrified, so that Billy's hands locked onto it hard. He was hauled into the airlock, and machinery closed the bottom door. Only then did the ladder, wound onto a reel in the airlock, let him go. Only then did Billy's brain start working again. There were two peepholes inside the airlock, with yellow eyes pressed to them. There was a speaker on the wall. The Tralfamadorians had no voice boxes. They communicated telepathically. They were able to talk to Billy by means of a computer and a sort of electric organ which made every earthling speech sound.
"Welcome aboard, Mr. Pilgrim," said the loudspeaker. "Any questions?"
Billy licked his lips, thought a while, inquired at last, "Why me?"
"That is a very earthling question to ask, Mr. Pilgrim. Why you? Why us, for that matter? Why anything? Because this moment simply is. Have you ever seen bugs trapped in amber?"
"Yes." Billy, in fact, had a paperweight in his office, which was a blob of polished amber with three ladybugs embedded in it.
"Well, here we are, Mr. Pilgrim, trapped in amber of this moment. There is no why."
The terrific acceleration of the saucer as it left Earth twisted Billy's slumbering body, distorted his face, dislodged him in time, sent him back to the war. When he regained consciousness, he wasn't on the flying saucer. He was in a boxcar crossing Germany again. Some people were rising from the floor of the car and others were lying down. Billy planned to lie down too. It would be lovely to sleep. Pilgrim, said a person he was about to nestle with, is that you? Billy didn't say anything, but nestled very politely, closed his eyes. God damn it, said the person, that is you, isn't it? He sat up and explored Billy rudely with his hands. It's you, all right. Get the hell out of here. So Billy stood up again, clung to the cross brace. Where can I sleep? He asked quietly. Not with me. Not with me, you son of a bitch, said somebody else. You yell, you kick. I do. And now there was an acrimonious madrigal with parts sung in all quarters of the car. Nearly everybody, seemingly, had an atrocity story of something Billy Pilgrim had done to him in his sleep. Everybody told Billy Pilgrim to keep the hell away. So Billy Pilgrim had to sleep standing up, or not sleep at all. And food had stopped coming in through the ventilators, and the days and nights were colder all the time. On the eighth day, the 40-year-old hobo said to Billy, This ain't bad. I can be comfortable anywhere. You can, said Billy. On the ninth day, the hobo died. So it goes. His last words were, You think this is bad? This ain't bad. There was something about death and the ninth day. There was a death on the ninth day in the car ahead of Billy's, too. Roland Weary died of gangrene that had started in his mangled feet. So it goes. Weary, in his nearly continuous delirium, told again and again of the Three Musketeers, acknowledged that he was dying, gave many messages to be delivered to his family in Pittsburgh. Above all, he wanted to be avenged, so he said again and again the name of the person who had killed him. Everyone on the car learned the lesson well. Who killed me? He would ask. And everybody knew the answer, which was this. Billy Pilgrim. On the tenth night, the peg was pulled out of the hasp on Billy's boxcar, and the door was opened. The train had arrived on a siding by a prison, which was originally constructed as an extermination camp for Russian prisoners of war. At the base of the pole from which the light bulb hung were three seeming haystacks. The Americans were wheedled and teased over to those three stacks, which weren't hay after all. They were overcoats taken from prisoners who were dead. So it goes. The coat that Billy Pilgrim got had been crumpled and frozen in such a way, and was so small, that it appeared to be not a coat, but a sort of large black three-cornered hat. There were gummy stains on it, too, like crankcase drainings or old strawberry jam. There seemed to be a dead, furry animal frozen to it. The animal was, in fact, the coat's fur collar. And Billy and the rest were encouraged to shuffle around their dinky train and into the prison camp. There wasn't anything warm or lively to attract them, merely long, low, narrow sheds by the thousands, with no lights inside. Somewhere a dog barked. With the help of fear and echoes and winter silences, that dog had a voice like a big bronze gong. Billy blacked out as he walked through gate after gate. He came to in what he thought might be a building on Trousfamidor. It was shrilly lit and lined with white tiles. It was on Earth, though. It was a de-lousing station through which all new prisoners had to pass. Billy did as he was told, took off his clothes. That was the first thing they told him to do on Trousfamidor, too. A German measured Billy's upper right arm with his thumb and forefinger, asked a companion what sort of an army would send a weakling like that to the front. They looked at the other American bodies now, pointed out a lot more that were nearly as bad as Billy's. One of the best bodies belonged to the oldest American by far, a high school teacher from Indianapolis. His name was Edgar Derby. He'd been in Roland Weary's car, had cradled Weary's head while he died. So it goes. Derby was 44 years old. He was so old, he had a son who was a Marine in the Pacific Theater of War. Derby's son would survive the war. Derby wouldn't. That good body of his would be filled with holes by a firing squad in Dresden in 68 days. So it goes.